All right. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. This is the Elemental Awakening podcast. Got a very special guest today, James W. Gesso. He's an author and podcaster, and he specializes in psychedelic culture, among many other things. He's got an incredible podcast that I've been listening to recently and just been falling in love with some of the conversations. I love his style. He's direct. He calls it as it is, asks very incredible questions. So I hope I can sort of reflect some of the same in this conversation today, because I want to dive deep into some of these topics. So James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. I noticed a shudder in your voice. Did you forget the name of my podcast? Did you gap as you were trying to introduce
Absolutely.
Me?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's cool, man. It's Adventures Through the Mind.
Yeah, because I was thinking the At Mind, but then I wasn't sure if that's the abbreviation.
It is. I'll give you a little like random backstory about At Mind, yeah.
Cool.
So Adventures Through the Mind was a thing that I called my website when I was just whatever, almost a decade ago. I was putting little like poetic blogs about consciousness out in the world that nobody would look at because nobody knew who I was and nobody was going to take my business card from a random person that they met and go under their website. You know, actually to respond to that, I started making zines, which was a way better way to get people to check out my stuff in the early beginnings. But I called it Adventures Through the Mind. So when I started the podcast, I called it At Mind Radio. But the challenge with a podcast called At Mind Radio is that since nobody really knew who I was and didn't know about that Adventures of the Mind, it was just a random word that meant nothing to anyone. So that's why I changed it to Adventures Through the Mind. And that's where At Mind continues from. But initially it was terrible, terrible branding. And now it's only mediocre. Yeah.
I love it. And I'd really recognize your podcast more from the logo that you use. I think it's a lion with the third eye with the mushrooms growing out of its brain. I just love that. So I just scroll down on my podcast and I find it. So please check that out. So yeah, let's just dive in a bit about, you know, we'll just touch on a little bit, like what got you into this, like a little bit of your backstory. On how you became an author and podcaster in this type of genre or topic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like any personal history, it weaves and it meanders and it goes back. I mean, it goes back to the movements of our peoples. You know, if we're gonna get into how ancestry, you know, eventually manifests into the sort of the personal familial social context in which we are birthed or into which we are birthed. But I feel like that's a little. Maybe a little too aggrandizing to tell that story. But I'd say that it started really being a very avid writer in my youth and then in my early 20s and then getting into drugs quite heavily. Early I was really interested in high school. I did a lot of pot smoking and eating mushrooms, but eating mushrooms in high school was like, when I wanted to party, but I wanted something stronger than weed, man. You know, like this kind of like uneducated use because that was what was available to me mm-hmm. 20 years ago. So there was that kind of uneducated use. And then in my around 22, 23, I got pretty heavy into using drugs in a party context, a lot of MDMA, a lot of speed, which was basically amphetamine plus who the hell knows. And basically whatever I get my hands on, including a lot of psychedelics, a lot of LSD, and a lot of reckless use, which sort of like came calling at some point, you know, like, the consequences come calling at some point, which left me in a bit of a turmoil. And the sort of intellectual foundations that I had in understanding psychedelics as valuable, which I use as intellectual justifications for their misuse in conjunction with many other substances as I was running away from, you know, myself or responsibility or my past or whatever it is. It was very escapist sort of use at that time in my life. Those intellectual foundations, although justifications previously, became foundations for responsible use later, when I was grappling with the consequences of all, not only the substance misuse, but all the relational, emotional, social consequences of that misuse, mixed with what it meant insofar as how I thought and felt about myself as a person in the larger arc of who I was trying to become based on where I came from and all this stuff that I didn't know I wasn't dealing with beforehand. And now I was really aware I wasn't dealing with now or couldn't deal with now because of all the psychedelics just like moving a bunch of stuff up. I also at one point had a drug-induced psychosis where I thought that I lived in Melbourne at the time, or Melbourne, and I felt like I lived in Dark City. I don't know if you ever saw that movie from the 90s, very weird film about this dude that just like randomly wakes up, and he wakes up in the midst of this sort of reality, this city, which is always night, and it's self-contained. There's no way out of the city, and all the inhabitants of the city believe only, like they believe that they're in a full world and everything is this, and there's a daytime and all the rest, but none of that's true. It's just that at some point every day, every 24 hours, the entire city gets put to sleep, and these weird sort of like bald alien overlord people come in and they extract their memories, put them in new situations and implant new memories, and then wake everybody up with these new memories and just watch how it unfolds inside of this weird sort of like bubble. And he wakes up and he's got powers and whatever, but I felt like I was in Dark City, like nothing else is real. But eventually, you know, getting back to this responsible use, I was kind of trying to make sense of all the stuff that I had done and why I was depressed and obsessed with conspiracy theories and angry all the time. And there was a lot of factors that had nothing to do with drugs. You know, I had just come back from a wild year traveling. I was living in my parents' basement back in my hometown, which I wasn't even living in before I left. And I didn't know what I was doing with my life and all these things. And I eventually sort of decided, based on the influence of Terrence McKenna primarily, that the psychedelics could offer me something very, very positive into a deeper healing, where previously it wasn't about healing. It was about psychonautics. It was about wild exploration. It was about getting fucked up. It was about enjoying myself. It was very hedonistic, which is fine, but in my case, it was not positive. I decided I would use them for healing. I actually wanted to start using ayahuasca because this was 2010, can't remember exactly, I think it's 2010 maybe. Ayahuasca wasn't available to me. I don't know if you remember 10 years ago, but unless you lived on the West Coast of anywhere.
You know? Yeah, I heard about it first in 2012.
Yeah.
And no one I knew what it was then. So this is a couple of years after that, so I can imagine.
Yeah, so it wasn't available to me, and when it was, if it was available, it would have been out of my broke living in my parents' basement price range. So I used mushrooms, and this is where I'm just going to jump and like finish the story very quickly.
Okay.
I decided I would use them to heal. I didn't know what that meant. I used them once a month, every month, at first with a friend who sat for me, sort of just kind of like hung out with me while I wandered through the park. And then later, he would be the person I'd go chat with when I was coming back from my deep solo journey. And then I moved, and then I was doing it by myself, totally like committed. I remember one time, I was so committed. I was like, it's the full moon. I'm taking my dose. I'm going to the park. But it was in Alberta. And it was like minus 40 degrees outside that night. And I just bundled the hell up and I went for it. And we could go back to the story later if you really want to know, but I'll leave for now. But I did this for once a month, every month for 13 months.
How was the minus 40? I love cold. I'm a Wim Hof guy, so I would love to. All
right, well, I wasn't Wim Hof. This is 2010, right? Wim Hof was still a twinkle in YouTube's eye at that point. So I was just sitting out there, and one of the things, I'm not sure, where do you live?
Toronto.
Oh, are you? Wow, okay. What's up, neighbor? One of the things when it's like super snowy is that it just like cuts sound, right? Mm-hmm. The ambient sound becomes very, very muted. So I'm out in this, not exactly forest, it's like a city park, Confederation Park for anyone who happened to live in Calgary. And I'm sitting there in the snow. I had made like a little mound, and I was being overwhelmed by the sound of the silence. I was being whelmed. I wasn't overwhelmed. And all these fractal visions and all these things. And it was so incredible. I was just like deep in a very mindful, meditative embrace of the psychedelic whelming of my experience. And every little sound, of course, you know, kind of came with this almost infinite asymmetrical reverberations of quasi-mechanical, but also somehow incredibly organic, you know, like tone to it. And I'm just in it. I'm just in it. And then I keep having this desire to get up, but I'm like, no, I'm like with this, you know, like desire to run, the desire to move. And I was just like, no, I'm with this. I'm in this cold, all the rest of this. And I'm sitting there and it's cold, obviously, but I'm bundled, so I'm all right. And then this one word pops into my head. And as soon as this word popped into my head, I don't know how long I've been sitting there, but a while. As soon as this one word popped into my head, I was like, oh, and I immediately packed up my stuff and started like walking around and did the rest of my trip like in movement. But yeah, so it was cold that night. Now, I'm pausing and waiting. I'm like trying to set the stage. Like, is he going to ask me what that one word is? But
yeah, well, I wasn't sure if you wanted to share it or not, but I'm definitely curious.
Yeah, it was hypothermia. Yeah, so I was like, I was cold. But
so do you think that the mushroom was telling you like, hey, like hypothermia is a thing? Like, where do you think that word came from?
Well, I mean, it could have come from just some part of my rational mind stepping in for a second and being like, dude, you're high on drugs. It's minus 40 and you're sitting in the snow.
Do you think that's what it was? Like
maybe, but it maybe. Also could have been the mushroom. Like I have then had then and have now still a sense that, you know, I mean, it could be just my mind talking to me.
So sure. I guess this is an interesting question I asked myself. Like, do you think the mushroom is a separate entity that you communicate with, or do you think it creates a dialogue within yourself and there's like some sort of chemical hallucinogenic reaction within you?
I think that I don't know.
Okay. Good.
Okay.
Good answer.
And in that don't know. Okay. I look at it like this. That could be the case. In the experience, it doesn't feel to be that way. It feels like I'm in communion with something that is outside of myself. But on an objective level, that's true. I am metabolically in communion with an exogenous influence that is in no small part running, you know, like it's behind the wheel right now for my sort of neurobiological function. So objectively, I am in communion with something. Now, is the voice of that thing an intelligent thing that is trying to tell me things and blah, blah, blah? I don't know. It seems to feel that way. It could be not. It could be. And I think that if I say, no, it isn't, it's just my mind, I miss out on something really positive. But if I say absolutely 100%, yes, it is, I could be blinding myself from truth. So I look at it from a sense of like, what's pragmatic here? Okay. So I can say that objectively, yes, I'm in communion with a thing. Subjectively, it feels that way as well. Pragmatically, it appears as though a lot opens for me insofar as capacity to learn, to grow, to explore, to trust, to surrender, if I acknowledge and regard that the thing I'm in communion with that manifests subjectively as an exogenous influence is actually a thing I am in communion with that is intelligent in the sense that it has some sense of agency, capacity to act on its own behalf, and that I'm in relationship with it, and that it can only speak through me, right? It has to use me to speak there, and that's why it's also coming from inside my own mind. But because I can have this relationship with this thing, I can work towards building and reinforcing a healthy, positive, generative relationship, something akin to teacher-student. And it could all be a bunch of shit that I've made up in my mind. But if I engage it knowing that it could not be true, but lean into Pascal's wager and say, you know what? Why not say that it is true, at least insofar as it feels true and it's pragmatic and it's positive and it's useful for me to regard its intelligence, regard that I'm in communion with it, that I'm in, and that communion arises out of a relationship that is living and dynamic and changes over time and exists with or without the mushrooms with me. You and I could have a relationship, and whether or not you're actually in my life or we're hanging out on that day, your influence is still present. I can still sustain that relationship in a way that I can still call forth, you know, what's present in that relationship in a way to inspire the way I'm moving the world. So I would say, yes, it is a thing that I'm interacting with and communing with that is intelligent and holds wisdom and has something to teach me if I diligently make myself a student to its lessons. And it could all be made up in my own head. So I also have to keep in mind not to take this too seriously, which coincidentally is also what they told me. Mushrooms. So,
yeah. Sounds like a bit of a loop. And the mushrooms are known, well, in my experience, to sometimes put me in those loop states where it's like the answer to the question is also the question. And I just remember times where I've gone to such a loop that the loop dissolved itself. Like it was my mind that was creating this loop of trying to ask the questions, but just being on both sides of it. Anyways, that probably doesn't make sense speaking it out loud, but please continue.
Actually, I feel like it does. I feel like it does make sense. And we get stuck into this place where we're trying very hard to rationalize what's happening. And then ultimately the rationalizations feed back into all the variables and considerations until it just kind of pops. And then when it pops, you're like, oh, it just is. Like, it's not actually the struggle of the rationalization. It's actually some sort of level of awareness that exists beyond that, that holds it but is greater than it. It contains all its parts, but it's greater than the sum of its parts. And then resting from that place, all of a sudden it makes sense in a way that it couldn't make sense when you're inside the circle of rationalizations. Mm-hmm. Does that sound like I understood what you're talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. So before we continue, just curious, when you started going down this path, where were you finding guidance on like doses? Were you just intuitively like how much you should be taking? Because you said you wanted to go the route of ayahuasca for healing. You ended up choosing mushrooms. Were you going like the traditional, again, Terrence McKenna, like hero dosage?
So that's a great question. I chose mushrooms, A, because I couldn't afford ayahuasca, mm-hmm. But also because, and I still feel this way, ayahuasca, at least in the beginning, requires a very skilled facilitator to hold your experience. And regardless of what that facilitator looks like, I believe a very skilled facilitator is necessary. That isn't to say that people couldn't take it on their own and not become damaged by it. But if it's going to be going in for deep healing, I think that it's necessary. So that was another thing. I didn't feel like mushrooms needed that as much so. I could also control the dose better. And I also, you know, I mean, I found out later that mushrooms very much can induce vomiting and sickness, but I didn't have to worry about vomiting and sickness, you know, and it was very easily accessible. Now, when I started doing it, I started at about, I think my first trip was 4 grams sitting in a field.
First trip?
Yeah. Well, not first trip ever, like the first trip in this.
Yeah.
Listening to delta wave binaural beats for like a really long time. It was super intense and it was hot and we were in a field and it was like a sticky summer's evening and there were so many mosquitoes and I was sweating and like just tripping so super hard. And I don't even remember what it was I was getting out of it except like a recognition of like, this is where we're going. This is what this is going to be. Like, you know, like this is the flush. Like these are the places you're entering. This is like, learn how to be with this, even though it's very difficult.
So do you think like, just on that question, do you think the mind has to cognitively recognize an answer to get a long-term benefit? Because sometimes the experiences will be incomprehensible. And sometimes it'd be like, here's the answer to your problem. This is why you do this.
Well, I mean, it depends because I don't think that they're all one or the other. I feel like it was recognizing in that it made sense because it was me being like, oh, this is really intense, learning how to surrender and be with what's happening despite how uncomfortable it is. What did that mean? That's what it meant to me in hindsight. Yeah. And after the meaning making has been facilitated long enough that I can, you know, conjure it up into a coherent narrative and the rhetoric that I'm sharing with somebody else. Right. But at the moment it just felt like overwhelming and I was just sort of getting cues to like, be with it. But what was that? Like, what was that really? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain things that aren't to be figured out. There are certain things that arise that are the mystery, you know? And if you figured it out, it wouldn't be a mystery anymore. You know, there are certain things that it's not about figuring out what that was. It was actually just about encountering the fact that it was inconceivable. Mm-hmm. You know, that you touched, you put your finger in the bubble of mystery, right? So I think it would just depend on what it is. Personally, I feel like even those experiences can be integrated in a way, because the integration would then focus on what was the lesson there. Okay, the lesson was possibly being taken apart by profound, you know, like transrational beauty or something. So then I would focus, the integration would focus on like wondering about beauty, wondering about what that experience might mean in my life, rather than what was that experience exactly.
Right?
Or like it that. It could be about the lesson or the integration could be around finding ways to be able to maintain a coherent sense of orientation inside of disorientation. Like to find a place of coherence and stability inside of uncertainty, inside of greater and greater degrees of uncertainty. Possibly it was actually was in trust. And the lesson in the integration isn't try to figure out what that happened there, but try to learn what that trust was and where does that sense of being able to trust and surrender onto something grander than myself come into play in the rest of my life.
Yeah, I like that. That makes a lot of sense. So starting at 4 grams, did you keep it in a similar sort of range? Did it always change? Did you build a relationship with them over time where you're more able to navigate the space? Curious about those kind of questions, if you care to entertain them.
Yeah. So, I mean, putting it back into the story, you know, I started taking them once a month, every month for 13 months. And then at the end of 13 months, the mushrooms were like, you're done now. Like, look at where you are in your life. There's no need to keep going. Now just learn, you know? So that's what I ended up doing. I ended up changing my practice after that. I started doing it with people again, because I would never do it with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Other people could be doing it possibly around me, maybe. Like, I had one evening where, I was getting the stories confused. That's not actually true. During that time, I only did it by myself or with that sitter who at some point I was no longer working with. And I would choose 4 grams. And I tried different amounts of them. Like I would do some nights where I would do like 2 grams. And I'd just go around walking around and I would just do a lot of self-reflecting and a lot of contemplation. And I would make notes on things that felt important. And I would really just dig into my life and I explore my environment. And then I do nights where I would do closer to 4 grams and I would have to have quite a bit of meditating of being with what's happening and really letting the emotions come up and move through me. And then there are times where I tried even more, which were cool and interesting, but I didn't feel like they brought me as much value in my life. So I ended up generally leaning towards 4 grams as my primary amount. And I've since done more. Like I've actually never done 5 dry grams in silent darkness. But I have done 5 gram trips several times.
What's the upper limit you've tested? Have you ever gone to like Kalindi type?
No. Kalindi, rest in peace, he was a man of his own. I mean, I know other people have gone there. I've met those people and I know people who have, you know, told me that they've gone there partly because of Kalindi's experiences or his sharing, but also because of their own journeys. But I never went there. I never felt it.
Just haven't felt the calling. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Cool. Yeah. I've been sort of thinking about what that could be like. Like I've done one pretty intense experience that I'm still trying to integrate because it was like nothing else that I'd ever experienced. It's just beyond, the mind was just like way too far gone. And it kind of scared me a little bit. Like that thought of not never coming back, like that was the new norm. And I sort of accepted it pretty easily. But I guess, is there a point that you think that there needs to be like a sitter there? Cause I know for sure that, and for me, like once you start getting into those much macro dose or high doses, like I wouldn't feel safe by myself in those higher realms. Did you feel at any time that if you want to go deeper, you would need like a sitter, or is that when you use a sitter?
I feel like I would talk more from my experiences now than at that time.
Okay.
At the time I was like 23, 24. I was like, you know, like in the first blossom of my manhood. you know, like I was charging, I was independent, I was this and that, you know, like not to mock it, but like that's actually where I was. I was like, mm-hmm. in my mind, I'm like, I'm a spiritual warrior, you know, where nowadays I've kind of chilled out a bit, a lot on that. I'm like, yeah, I'm also like a very delicate, vulnerable human that can be completely crippled by these experiences. So I should probably mm-hmm. be careful. it was like, one thing that I had said to my partner when she was asking me about sort of like my journey of entrepreneurship. And I said, I think the thing that allowed me to succeed is that at the time that I was first laying the foundations of it, I was actually I was too immature and ignorant to recognize that I actually could fail. Right. And somehow I just did it. And then increasingly I was like, wow, I was walking a cliff edge that whole time. Holy goodness. But yeah, so what was your question? Oh, yes, a sitter. So things really changed for me with mushrooms after 2014. I'd had several difficult experiences on a variety of things. You know, like that was part of the course. You know, sometimes it got tough. And I had a lot of difficult experiences with psilocybin, all of them being rather positive. But generally, I still wasn't doing sitters. I was always either with friends, we were all doing it, or I was doing it on my own. And then after 2014, I had a medical emergency at an ayahuasca center where I nearly died.
Oh, wow.
And the consequence of that, fast forward whatever, a year and a half, is my whole life had changed and I had developed post-traumatic stress disorder.
Due to an ayahuasca ceremony?
Due to nearly dying in the jungle.
Wow.
While also being at an ayahuasca center and also not recognizing my own vulnerabilities and deciding to leave that retreat center the very next day when it ended and get dropped off on their way back to Iquitos to go into another retreat deeper into the jungle with more isolation and more ayahuasca. So, I mean, I did to myself, right? You know, like I made these choices. But the thing, and I've learned this in more detail from people who have been doing mushroom ceremonies for a long time and brilliant people, brilliant woman, Françoise Berzat, is that after trauma, it can be very difficult to have psilocybin experiences because it's very difficult to surrender because the overwhelm of the traumatic experience always comes back in some level and another. And I've done a lot of really intense work to go through that trauma, including I thought I could just take more psychedelics. And I did, thinking to myself, oh, well, the problem was that I just, you know, I almost died physically and I'm stuck now. So I have like reincarnating trauma or something like that, or reentry trauma. So I just got to take psychedelics. I got to take enough of them that I die all over again. And this time I'll just fully surrender and I'll be like, fine, right? Turns out it doesn't really work that way. Although on some level kind of did, but I ended up just like taking more psychedelics and different kinds of psychedelics to try to like push past. And it just, each time I learned something, but I usually learned something from the mistakes that would come out as a consequence of it and really being blindsided by how much that trauma would come in. And these days it's not so much like, although every time I take psychedelics, even though I've done a lot of work, done a lot of trauma healing, every single time, I know there will be a moment where I will have to face the fear that I am dying a violent death
alone
in the jungle every single time, you know, and sometimes I move through it really gracefully and other times it's much more difficult. And so that really showed me how overwhelming a psychedelic experience can be. And it also helped me really understand how powerful and how positive it can be to have another person there to hold my hand, or I could look at and be like notably distressed and then be like, it's okay, trust and surrender, boom. Or even this past year at the end of 2019, I was in Vancouver and I did the things that are coming up, like in Vancouver, for example, there's these whole communities of people who basically do ayahuasca circles, but they're not ayahuasca circles, they're mushroom circles. They have ayahuasca ceremony-esque feel to them, but they're its own culture of neo-shamanic mushroom.
Those are also happening in Toronto, yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, I know at least a handful of people, that, cool. But I haven't sat with them, so I don't know what that's like, but that's what that was there. And being able to speak to one of the facilitators, they use the term angels, I think, to be able to say, like, this experience is happening to me, and then be able to offer just the most gentlest, like, why don't you ask the mushrooms why they're showing this to you? You know, like, just that reminder. You know,
so yeah,
in that sense, I feel that's... very strongly about guides. I also see there's a lot of value in being able to do the alone in the alone, which is Kalindi, you know, quoting Terence, quoting somebody else, but going the alone in the alone, I still have done that since then.
Mm-hmm.
And I find a lot of value and power there.
Is there a right way, a wrong way? Like there's all these, like I even ask myself too, when I do some of the deeper experiences, like if I'll have a sitter, I don't know if I should say, hey, maybe you should sometimes ask me to try and explain what I'm experiencing, because I would love to sort of have that, because sometimes I'm so deep that I can't remember it. And if I tried to verbalize it, maybe something would come through that I could bring back after. But then do I even need that if it's not supposed to come back and I don't remember it? Or like as a role of a sitter, is it like supposed to be something spontaneous, or is it supposed to be like a protocol to follow? Like, hey, I'm going to come and check on you and hug you and ask if you're okay or hold your hand. Or is it just like, whatever happens, happens, allow this magic to unfold. And, you know, so, and there's so many different, I guess, ideas of what, of how things should be done. Everyone's got their different ways. And it's not to say one is right or one is wrong. I think Chad was talking about this in your interview. It's just the power of just coming together and sort of sharing what's working and what the experiences are like. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's super interesting. I think I just sidetracked.
Let me comment here on something.
Yeah.
In regards to your wondering about a sitter, you know, if someone wants to know how to be a sitter from like a protocol standpoint, I suggest reading Psychedelic Psychotherapy by R. Coleman, step by step, how to be a sitter. That's great. But insofar as you wanting to have a mushroom experience, the question of like, what are you going in to sort out? You know, like, why are you doing it? What is the context of the use? Like, is it at home? Is it in the woods? Is it like in a group? Is it by yourself? You know, all of these things present variables that the role of the sitter will be dependent upon those contextual variables. And maybe from your standpoint, it's experimental. It's very psychonautic. Sure. It's like, maybe you should say, like, if it looks like I'm really being moved by something, say the key, like, cue me to try to explain it to you. And maybe you'll very quickly learn that that is not possible. You're just saying, wow, over and over again, you know, but like, and from an experimental standpoint, sure, you know, it's your right to experiment with it. I personally feel like it's your right to experiment with it, from a cognitive liberty standpoint, in whatever way. I mean, philosophically, whatever you want to do, I think should be your right to do, as long as it doesn't cause harm to other people. But from a personal standpoint, I lean into that, but also suggest, please don't cause harm to yourself either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So one of the other things that I want to point out is whether or not you're doing this alone, or you're doing this with a sitter, or you're doing this with a group, or you're doing this with a partner, or you're doing this, whatever the context is, you know, I think that it's, I don't know if dangerous kind of like gives this sort of intensity to it. It's dangerous, you know, like you lose your arm, you know, but I'd say that from a position of like, what is most optimal from a life well lived, examined life well lived standpoint for taking psilocybin or psychedelics, I truly believe that it does not serve us to do this work in a vacuum. We do not exist in a vacuum, despite what the sort of like individualism, sort of like capitalist model of social Darwinism and competition and all the rest might suggest. This work does not bode well for us if we do it in a vacuum. And so if we're going to do it alone, or we're going to do it in a group or whatever, we find ways to ensure that what is learned, what is experienced, the fact that it's even happening, is included in the perception of you by the other people in your life. Now, that's obviously, we're talking about a highly stigmatized illegal activity. So be mindful about like who you're telling and how and whatever, you know, right? You might not call up the cops and be like, hey, just to let you know, I'll be taking some illegal drugs tonight. So I might be calling and freaking out. This is my home address. This is where I hide them in case I need more. So doing it in a vacuum, I don't think serves us, because we are creatures that live in relationship. We thrive in relationship. We also drown in relationship, you know, and that all of these lessons that we're learning, this personal growth, which I'm not a big fan of that word, this, we'll say personal development, this personal betterment, this trauma healing, all the rest of this. Yes, of course, it's for you to live a happier, healthier life, more generative, more resilient, more whatever. But for what? Like, we don't exist in a vacuum. When we're doing this work, we're doing it. And when we become better people, we become better people on behalf of everyone we care about, because we show up better into their lives. We're less likely to hurt other people. I mean, not definitely, despite doing a lot of good work. In my worst of days, I've done things that have hurt other people. Mm-hmm. These are places where I've then gotten to access the shame and the guilt and where those actions came from. And so the trauma of that, so that also added to my life in a way, and then added to relationships by going through, you know, restorative conflict resolutions and circles and stuff like this, when this has happened and when I've supported other people in those processes and so on and so forth. Right. Mm-hmm. But yet, if we're going to do it even alone, to consider that it doesn't operate in a vacuum, that we have someone that knows that we're going, we have someone we could call if we need to, we have someone who's going to welcome us back, who's going to say, welcome back. What did you learn? Like, where did you go? Like, I'm curious. I want to know about you. People that we trust to reveal ourselves to, psychedelics or not, to build relationships where our lives don't exist in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. You know, our deepest intimacies don't exist in a vacuum. And I feel like I've kind of gone on a tangent there, but that's my point. It's like, sit or not, to remember that this work should, I don't think, serves us to be existent in a vacuum. And in the contrary, which is that I believe it serves not only us, but those around us, when we openly and maturely include the intimacy of our psychedelic experiences into our relationships. And on the flip side, that we allow ourselves to, or engage ourselves in ways that invite those of our friends groups who are going on those psychedelic experiences to bring and reveal those intimacies to us, that we are landing places, we are mantle places for what they have learned. Mm-hmm. And that we lovingly respect and listen critically, but listen.
Well, and that's what I love about, you know, like people like yourself who openly have a podcast about these things, to sort of be a leader in the space and share and allow people to share experiences that other people can choose to listen or to be inspired by, or to sort of question their own appetite to have their own experiences. And even in my own experience, when I wanted to make a documentary, there was a lot of fear that came up with the stigmatization, and, you know, but there was overwhelming, like, feeling like it's more important to share this than to be worried about being afraid of how people are going to judge you, because you mm-hmm. want to just share about your experience, because I truly believe this is very healing and can help shift humanity. And I think it is right now. And I'd love to get your perspective on where you think this is going as an industry, as a culture. You know, there's definitely a renaissance when it comes to psychedelics, and maybe they've been around forever, but there's definitely coming more of a mainstream awareness towards them, and like people in like the capitalistic sense are starting to get their eyes on it, and more people are moving towards it for healing. So maybe just your perspective on where you see this going on different levels. Or where you'd like to see it go, maybe, is a better question.
They're different questions. I mean, like, where I'd like to see it go. Egalitarian utopia for all people, the return of biodiversity, the advancement of human technological capacities so that we could live in symbiotic harmony with the planet, even go off planet in a way that doesn't limit our ability to express our ingenuity in dynamic and futuristic ways.
And do you believe that's possible?
I believe if we get over ourselves a little bit, maybe it could be possible, but...
And you think plant medicine could be a catalyst towards that possibility?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think it already has been a catalyst on many levels. I mean, mm-hmm. if you look back through history, some of the greatest scientific breakthroughs have been as a consequence, maybe all the greatest scientific breakthroughs have been as a consequence of entering an altered state, some of which induced by psychedelics, some very meaningful ones, you know, like what's the discovery or of the double helix, or can't remember this other one, but it had something to do with corn. That's not very helpful. I mean, geez, the iPhone, maybe, you know, so it's like, yeah. So I think that it could and has already moved towards that. You know, I feel like this is ridiculous, but it's like, I was thinking about like how trippy psychedelic you would have to be to think, you know, what's a good idea? Putting people on the moon. Let's do that. You know, let's not just look at it. Let's go there.
Let's
build. I mean, this could actually be very egocentric, very masculine, dominant, toxic. Like, yeah, let's build a giant fucking rocket. And we'll just like, like a bunch of explosions, controlled explosions, and we'll just. We'll just like shoot our hard rocket like, right into the moon. Oh, and then we'll just like release our men into the moon. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. No.
Very great representation of that type of energy and where that could come from.
I mean, yeah, maybe. But I mean, I know I'm just like throwing stuff out there. I'm having fun with it. But
I love it, man. I love it.
To answer your question, though. You know, it's impossible right now, I think, for us to have any reasonable conversation about where the world is going without keeping into consideration that we're at a dynamic turning point for the future of our civilization as a consequence of the COVID pandemic, right? Because we don't know where this is going. We don't know what this virus is going to mean. Is it going to be over in 2 years like the other major coronaviruses are? Is it going to fundamentally change like the way human health operates insofar as like environmental atmospheric toxins? You know, like is this going to collapse economies? Is this going to push economies even greater into like corporatocracy? I don't know if that's the right word, but like, you know, like the absolute destruction of mom and pop brick and mortars. And like the dominance of the Bezos of the world. I mean, like Bezos, like kind of a pretty unique guy, but like the Amazons and the Walmarts and so on and so forth. Is this our stepping into the type of totalitarian control state, you know, that Orwell foretold, like the deep, like the dystopian nightmare of all our best/worst science fictions? We don't know. Or is this the turning point for humanity to take a long, hard look at what's happening here? Because COVID is absolutely a problem, but COVID is a little blip. COVID is nothing compared to what's coming. Mm-hmm. You know, like with like the collapse of biodiversity, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, like the idea that possibly we could get to a point where every single day in the hot months is a day where it's unsafe to be outside because it's so hot. We got food shortages from a lack of farm work this year. It's coming, you know, but what about a food work because we have a lack of being able to grow food because our fields are just getting dried up because it's not raining, or because the growing season is all confused because there's no spring really. It just goes from like snowing to like toxic levels of heat. We don't know what's coming, right? And it's almost definitely going to be way more intense than COVID. So insofar as like what psychedelics could offer, man, that's kind of hard. Like we don't even know what's going to happen to us, right? We might end up positively shifting gears. You know, like I love this tweet that I saw, which was like, it feels like the entire world has been punished, has been grounded and told to go to our rooms and think.
I read something similar. Right? Yeah, I like that.
And maybe that ends up being something very positive, but I don't know. I mean, I see a lot of people around who in my mind are acting like dum-dums. Mm-hmm. You know, like here in Kitchener, it's like, oh, they've started phase one. Like we've got Doug Ford. This is, I mean, for the people who aren't from Ontario or Toronto, like we've got the leader of our province saying like, so let's slowly start opening, but we don't even know how many people have COVID in this province, except like a whole hell of a lot, you know, and we open up stores and then all of a sudden there's crowds in front of the stores, like marshals and winners. And it's like, what are all these people rushing off to do?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my God, I just really need new bath pillows or bath towels and throw pillows. And like, the amount of people that I see wearing the mask with their nose out and like taking it on and off. And like, it's just like, I want to be optimistic that the trend, and very much so the trend, is towards greater levels of well-being for more people. Although in that we've of course seen disparity and inequality and racism and classism and sexism and misogyny and all the rest, that's there too. And also as a part of the trend of our civilization is the fact that more and more people know about that. More and more action is being taken to try to correct for those issues in our society. So in the trend line, maybe we go way up, but also maybe the weight of our own idiocy will cut us off at the knees long before we get there. And I don't know. So what role might psychedelics play in that? Well, you know, maybe it'll help people feel more connected to nature and all these other positive things about psychedelics. But today I'm not feeling particularly optimistic. And I wonder what psychedelics could do, if anything at all, if we're all living under the guise of a virus, meaning that we have to be under totalitarian control of our governments, and there's no such thing as small business or whatever. There's only like giant extractivist corporations. Now, I'm not to say that I don't believe the virus is real. I think it's a very serious issue, absolutely. And these things are other serious issues. So I don't really know at this time. I'm going to continue to talk about psychedelics and do the good work of building the culture, because I think it's positive to do that at the very least, and also kind of get a little break from COVID from time to time.
There's an interesting quote, I think.
I don't know.
There's an interesting quote. I believe it was Terence McKenna, and I believe it was in respect to someone asking him what a psychedelic experience would be like. And I think this is probably also rings true for our future. It's like, whatever you think it's going to be like, it probably is not going to be that. It's almost positive that it won't be what you think it is, you know? And for that reason, I'm an optimist too. Like if you went 30 years back in time, or 50 years or 100 years, and tried to predict what it'd be like now, it would be nothing like it is actually right now. So, you know, in a way I look at it as an optimist that I think we're smart enough to solve our issues with technology if we can stop fighting about stupid shit, you know, all these wars and needless stuff. And I think that,
please go ahead, sorry.
Then I think that psychedelics show people that they're more alike than different, and the more people that do it in a responsible way might have more realizations like, hey, like you shouldn't be fighting over these stupid things and try to work together. But anyway, so what you're gonna say?
Well, I actually interrupted you, so I'm gonna need to apologize. Very Canadian podcast here. oh my God, I just saw this terrible meme, which is like somebody being like, I'm afraid. I have an irrational fear of Canadians, really quietly. And the therapist is like, I'm sorry. And he starts screaming. God damn it. What was your question?
No, I was just saying about like the future and being an optimist and how it's probably not what you think it's going to be.
Okay. I remember
war and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. That we could solve our problems with technology. Well, I think we're creating more problems than we're solving with technology here now, but again, like the trend lines, maybe that changes, you know? I mean, like the internet is an incredible technology. Look at what it's done for us on so many levels. And yet it's because of the internet that flat earth theory is a thing and Karens are burning down 5G towers or whatever, you know? So, what I was going to bring up though is I recently read this book. I thought it was very good. I interviewed the author. It's called Dear Machine. The author is Greg Kaiser. And it's a hypothetical sort of like, it's a book that looks at him writing to a hypothetical future entity, which is a super aware intelligent machine that is capable of super systemic thinking. So it's like systems thinking, but like layers of abstraction beyond systems thinking, in a way that will align that the best way for it to survive itself is to help humans in doing good and like biodiversity and restorative agriculture and all the rest of this. And that at some point it will develop, not because we were trying to develop it, but it just will. And it'll push us towards going beyond our own impediments to achieve the thing that we couldn't achieve on our own, because we needed technology's ability to transcend our illusory individual self, which limits us. You know, the illusory individual self that only thinks in perspective of its own lifetime, and our inability to accurately like harvest mass amounts of data and to make good assumptions based on that data, which we as humans don't do very well. We do it reasonably well if it's like trying to figure out how to like grow crops and not get, you know, mauled by bears. But when it comes to looking at global economic crises and like contagions moving around and like whatever else, clearly we're not really that great at it, right?
So yeah, I think I love that. And I really believe that that's a very good possibility. And, you know, I think the problem is like humans try to manipulate data for our own sort of benefits. You know, like a company will pick cherry pick the data, but a computer that doesn't have that said, okay, like how do I use all this data to make the best decision for humanity? And if that sort of takes over, that AI runs its thing, there's a good virus that breaks the internet and takes over, like it's possible. It's possible.
So yeah, when I was reading the book, I was thinking about, I'm a huge fan of, I know that the author ended up being a contentious fellow because I think of his, some of his views on abortion, but that aside, I mean, like that's a serious issue, but I mean, to me, that's not going to prevent me from being able to talk about and enjoy like his lifelong work of writing sci-fi fiction that all happened before he even made these political statements or whatever, right? Which is Orson Scott Card and the Ender series. And one of the things inside of the Ender series is an intelligence that wakes up inside of the interplanetary network of computers and is like, it has like an individual self-reflective awareness, but is also an extension of every single computer node and all access to all information at all times, but can make creative individual choices. So even as I was reading that, I'm like, oh, that'd be great.
I think the same thing can happen within humans, that this intelligence can wake up within us and shift us simultaneously, like around the entire world. Like, I think it's possible the way the planets work, we're going to different parts of the solar system and the Milky Way, and different energies can come in. I read a theory once that our evolution was one of, when we went from, I think, like, we converted from like caveman or like the missing link to now, there was a supernova that exploded in the universe. And when those rays hit the Earth at that time is when they showed this, that's when the missing link happened, when we evolved. It was that, like those photonic light beams that caused us to evolve. So, you know, it's an interesting theory, but it's also makes sense to me that, you know, maybe we're going to move into a different part of the universe and people are just like, wait a minute, like we don't need to fight anymore. Let's just drop our weapons and like do something different. Will it happen in this instant? Probably not. But maybe we're experiencing that now. Maybe that's why the world is changing. Who knows? You know, and I could be open-minded to the possibility.
Yeah, I mean, that actually sort of harkens back to some of the thinking that was around the 2012, the great shift of 2012, which I actually think 2012 was actually a very powerful transformation for humanity because of sort of what it invited people to think about, even if the end did not come. You know? But I feel like it's not hard to sort of like, I mean, we gotta extrapolate and take steps, but we know that, you know, we know that exogenous electromagnetic fields can change brain function. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like or sort of transcranial what's that stuff like? TDLR or no, that's too long, didn't read. Transmagnetic conduction on the transcranial magnetic conduction. What's this word where they have like basically magnets on your head and they change the frequency flow of the magnets, which change the way your brain functions.
Yeah, okay.
So we can use exogenous electromagnetic fields to change brain function, which means change the subjective experiences of consciousness. Experiences ongoingly change the way your cells express and your brain expresses sort of neuroplasticity, but we also have epigenetic changes based on experience. So if we look at electromagnetic fields, we put that into environment. So the planets, like everything around us has some sort of electromagnetic field influence.
They're even saying right now the electromagnetic field of the Earth is changing, like right now. Like,
well, it's weakening. I was going to point that out. But any number of things, not just electromagnetics, but also like smells, sensations on the skin, essential oils that we're coming in contact with, microbes and all the rest, or lack of microbes. There's all these exogenous things that can change the way our brain works. And so if we extend that to the planet, if the electromagnetic field of the planet, as it is expressed in its microclimates based on what's living there and how it's being impacted by electromagnetic fields, of course, moving into different sort of like cellular galactic disposition, so we move into a different place in the Milky Way, the cosmic forces would change electromagnetic functioning of the planet, which would change human consciousness on some level or another. And shit, I mean, like, even just super pragmatically, like, when it gets hotter, people get more irritable. So the hotter it gets as a consequence of what we're doing, the more likely we are to make impulsive conflict decisions. So maybe as a, you know, as the Earth spirals around, as the Earth chases the sun in this Fibonacci spiral, as the sun sort of like, you know, blasts its way circling around the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy over the billions and billions of years or whatever it is, then over time, we're going to enter into different sort of cosmic environmental conditions, and it'll change the functioning of human consciousness. Maybe that's what's happening right now with the, I mean, some people will use that as some excuse not to regard human-caused climate change. You know, like, oh, it's just cosmic conditions, man. We don't have to stop polluting. Why would we stop polluting? Like, it's obvious that it's just the solar system that's changing the planet's heat, you know, whatever. Yeah. And possibly it's, you know, maybe it's possible that we as a human species have an influence on the magnetic fields of the Earth. I mean, yeah, okay, so we don't have any scientific evidence that telekinesis is real. Sure, okay, maybe I think we might have some, I don't know. You know, and maybe it's unreasonable to suggest this is the case, but that doesn't mean it's not the case.
Well, there were some experiments by, are you familiar with Cleve Baxter's experiments?
No.
He was the, he was a police officer, and he was, he led the lie detector tests, and what he ended up doing was he put a lie detector on a plant, and when he envisioned that he was going to burn the plant gave an electric response to the lie detector. Mm-hmm. So it was a way to show that just by his thoughts, he could influence a bioelectric charge in the plant. And they did all these different experiments where they would take like human cells, put them on a millimeter volt sort of measuring device. And when that person would walk through town, when they'd walk by a very dark or scary area, you'd see a response. So like there was this like some communication going on beyond, you know, like a verbal communication, some sort of telekinetic.
Yeah, I mean we are intrinsically interrelated with each other. Like that was the whole premise that I said before about Greg Kaiser's work, that one of the cognitive impediments that prevents us from being able to solve the problems we face collectively, excuse me, is that we have this illusory self, which is very much an illusion. Obviously, like I am here, you are there. The boundaries of my skin is a pretty reasonable place to end, to find the lines between self and other, right? But then if you really go down into things, it's like it starts to become increasingly more arbitrary. I mean, like the whole premise of like, you know, 98% of my hand is actually empty space, or whatever it is. But then even looking into microbes and the sense of self, anyways, I have a different body than you do, mm-hmm. but my sense of self is influenced by so many other factors that are not just what's contained inside of my skin.
Mm-hmm.
So
interesting. Yeah. So let's switch gears a bit. We're almost at the hour mark here. I love these conversations.
I mean, we're going to places that I don't normally talk about, like all this electromagnetic stuff. I'm just going on, like, this is me just going on wild, playful conjecture with you, because here we are. We might as well.
You know, it's fun. You know,
apocalypse. Let's just throw it all out there.
I guess got two more questions for you. One is, I know you've interviewed a lot of interesting people. Is there one person that just totally blew your mind, whether it was the context of your conversation or what they're doing? Was there one guest that really stood out for you on your podcast that was like, wow, you either learned a lot, shifted your perspective on something?
You know, it's kind of tough to say, because generally the vast majority of people I have on the show because I'm already learning from them. Or I'm like giddy to have them on the show because I've already learned so much. Mm-hmm. So it's really tough to say. I feel like it would be unfair for me to point to any one. I have learned quite a bit from a number of the guests though. Like I've learned quite a bit from Bruce Sanguin. I learned quite a bit from Darshan Narvaez. I learned quite a bit from Mark Wolin. I've actually learned quite a bit from Françoise Brissette, who was a recent guest. from Rosalind Watts, also a fairly recent guest from chat. See, I could just start listing people off.
And it goes I feel on. Like it's different things from different people.
Yeah, I'd say that if there's one person who within the last 5 years I feel has had the most foundational shift in the way I show up in the world, it would be, who has also been on the show, it would be Stephen Jenkinson, and in particular his work around dying, his book Die Wise, and his numerous talks that he's given over the years. I have very much immersed myself, not nearly as much as others by any means, but I have immersed myself quite a bit in his work for a while and really let it change me at the core. But
how many times have you died in your experiences? Is it a common experience for you, the death experience through psychedelics?
No, I mean, encountering my dying, yes. Having experiences where I return and then all of a sudden come to be like, oh, wow. Like, I've definitely had experiences where, like, I'm dead. Holy shit. But, like, I guess, yeah, I maybe like 5 or 6 times. I generally don't take a lot of high doses. I mean, we talked about the trauma, you know, mm-hmm. like I'm mindful of not only trauma things, but also mindful of continuing to do my work in the world. And at mm-hmm. some point I'll get to a place where the responsibilities I have with the podcast, with my other writing and studying projects, with being an uncle, with being a partner, you know, with my, I mean, teaching isn't anything right now because we're all in sheltering in place and whatever. But when those responsibilities require less of me and I can give myself a wider berth to be spacey and confused and unsure and like unreliable about life, then I'll probably start taking some bigger doses again, because mm-hmm. generally that's the consequence for a time mm-hmm. afterwards. You've had yep. profound experiences. You know, like, how good were you at doing your regular day-to-day work when you were trying to make sense of the fact that your consciousness was obliterated into like a trillion sort of like infinitely reflective shards of glass that was being permeated throughout the universe, and that, you know, like your existence as an individual human being is a giant psychotic episode and you're actually one divine being moving through the cosmos beyond time and space. It's like, how do you go back to your cafe job after that and still be able to?
Yeah, I think it's also different for everyone too. Some people go through that and become inspired, like to live life like from a totally different. Some people just need so much time to integrate. This is my own experience. I've had both, where it's just like nothing and then everything.
Well, for myself, I just know that
you want to make sure you have the time. Yeah.
Yeah, I need time to even, like, I could probably get back to work right away, sure, but why would I want to?
Why would you want to? Yeah.
You know, like, if I'm going into Journey Deep and Explore, I want to give myself space to make sense of it after.
Yeah. Second last question. I lied. Is there someone that you haven't interviewed that you really want to interview on the show? Is there anyone out there that's really someone you've always wanted to pick their brain or talk to?
I think I'm kind of gapping on his name, but Frederick Barrett, he's a cognitive neuroscientist that does a lot of like fMRI work with psilocybin, who has never responded to email. I would love to interview him. Living people, or is this like really beyond, like living or dead?
Both, I guess. Yeah, that was living. I mean, give me one dead person you'd love to interview.
Terrence McKenna.
Okay, that's the obvious. I mean,
like, just color me typical here. Color me stereotype. Let me have a second with this one. Actually, there's nobody really that's coming to mind. I mean, practically Frederick Barrett. Yeah. There's a guy here. His work, Francis Weller. The Wild Edge of Sorrow, his work around grief, I find really interesting. I'd like to interview him. I'd love to interview Gabor Mate. His work is really good. But otherwise, like, I've pretty much interviewed Jim Carrey, maybe. I find it interesting that
I find
Jim
interesting
Carrey
too.
On the show to talk about consciousness, although I think he's sort of like, he's a bit wigged out, I think, but possibly he's also brilliant. So it'd be interesting to talk with him.
Yeah, I feel similar. Okay, so I guess to wrap up, you know, we didn't hit a lot of the questions that I initially set out to, but I think we just let the conversation flow in a nice way. So I'll come back to, so how did you then end up becoming a writer and your books and start the podcast from these experiences. Because I think we can finish off with the end of your story that you started, and we just segued through just a free-flowing conversation. So maybe we can close off with that, and you can tell people where they can experience that. So
yeah, so I had been avid about writing anyways. Like, I actually, before I got into the psychedelic writing stuff, I had actually was wanting to become a comedic travel writer. That was my goal. And I ended up a travel writer, thinking about trips and stuff. But at the end of all my work with psilocybin, I had been writing about it from a philosophical standpoint. I increasingly was writing philosophical poetry and sort of like poetic prose and genre nonfiction. But I ended up having an experience of telling people what I was learning and them telling me that it was really positively transforming their lives and that I should share it with more people. And I had a mushroom experience that told me I should write a book about what I had learned and a book that would help other people learn to relate to the mushrooms the way that I do, which we didn't even talk about that at all. Like, we didn't even touch on my thoughts around like the honesty of your emotions and being able to, what it means to surrender and how to be with the experience in a way that helps clear old emotional wounding and this kind of stuff. But there was a call to write about it, which is what I ended up doing. I put quite a bit of time into writing a very rational, very scholarly essay, extended essay, which became a book, Decomposing the Shadow, which was about working with psilocybin, in particular, how the difficult experiences can actually be quite positive.
That was one of my biggest learnings in all the psychedelic work is the difficult ones is not to be afraid of. It's almost to welcome it with open arms, knowing that it's going to be scary and difficult, you know, but
yeah, I was going to say you're still going to be afraid. I mean, like, anyone who's not afraid, I think, is a little stupid, because it's like shit can get scary in there. It's not about not being afraid. It's about sort of like doing what needs to be done to care for the variables, to make sure no harm is being occasioned to you, but also recognizing like you have no control and you could be shown some incredibly terrifying stuff. You know, or beyond terrifying, you can have to touch the deepest parts of your shame and your guilt and your grief. And you, on some level, you need to be able to have the courage before and the courage during to let that happen. By before, I mean like the courage to actually take the dose, and then during, the courage to accept and surrender. And that courage can also, and I believe it's served, in being supported by somebody else who's there to hold your hand or help you breathe.
Yeah. And I found like when I was courageous and I did surrender, I would usually, there would be some reward or insight at the end of the tunnel that was almost like a gift. It was like, hard to put into words, but it was like this process, or it was like you get beat up, you know, you go through the ringer, and then after, it's like this little nugget of wisdom that you take with you for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, that was so worth it. You know, like all that pain and suffering and dealing with my own bullshit. And then it's like, hey, here's a little like takeaway that's going to help you on the rest of your journey.
Yeah. I mean, to paraphrase Christopher Bache, who is an incredible writer, philosopher, psychonaut, also really nice guy.
I listened to that podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. He's cool, man. I if anyone hasn't, do I have his book? Oh, it's not on my desk right now, but his book, Diamonds from Heaven, about his 73 high dose LSD sessions to try to map the mind of the universe is pretty wild.
I just bought it actually. Yeah.
But anyway, sort of like paraphrasing him, which is that like the suffering and the blessings come in equal measure, as long as you can trust into the suffering. And usually it's like they come in equal measure, which means like if it's hard, it's going to be beautiful, but it might not always be at the same time. You might not always have like, this one is really hard, and so before it's done, I'm going to feel really happy. You know, it actually might just be really hard the whole time, but the consequence of going through it and then doing the work of making sense of it and caring for yourself and the vulnerability it opened within you and bringing that into the way you show up in your relational life, you know, the blessings on the other end of that are profound.
Well, yeah, that makes total sense. One experience I was telling you about, the high dose psilocybin, I was actually experienced both at the same time, the worst pain and the most pleasure, like simultaneously. And where I would think about it would just go there, but then it would just be showing me that the same time was happening. So anyhow, I don't want to digress too much more. So was there one like main lesson from your experience with all the mushrooms, like one major takeaway, or it's a lot of smaller lessons that are compact in the book? So what I would like to do is I bought your book, or I haven't bought your book. I was going to buy it today, but I want to ask you, rather than buying it on Amazon or somewhere else, where I could buy your book that would support you the most. And I want to read it and then maybe talk to you about the contents of the book on another podcast, you know, maybe a few months from there.
I would say that regardless of where you buy it, it's fine. I used to have like a buy it from me and get it signed thing, but in all honesty, right now I'm trying not to go out. So I don't want to go to the post office. So they've been removed from my site. I also had like really cool blotter art that I was selling and stuff too. I mean, like obviously undip, but yeah, I'm not selling that anymore. So any online seller that's not price gouging, because some people, I have a book that's unavailable now and I've seen it price gouged for like $200. Anywhere that isn't Amazon, I mean, you can buy it from Amazon, but I think like given the current sort of behavior of Jeff Bezos, and his company, I feel like that's not really a company that I think is really like not the kind of company I want to be supporting right now. Although I am slightly beholden to getting paid because much of my income is made through, or like a portion of my income is made through Amazon's like book selling services. But if you get it through any place that isn't Amazon, it's going through a different company. So you could do that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, thank you. So yeah, one last takeaway, something from the mushrooms that left a lasting message on you. And then,
I mean, it feels like, I'm not making this claim against you, sort of a general statement, that it feels unfair to expect myself to do that. Mm-hmm. Although something that's coming to the surface right now, has to do with the value of tempered emotional vulnerability. Mm. And by that, I mean that there's a value in letting ourselves really feel and letting people in to our most vulnerable, tender places. And obviously there's a lot there about healthy relationships and being careful about power dynamics and trauma and all the rest, but leave that aside. But there's a deep value in letting ourselves be vulnerable, to feel the difficult feelings, to feel our sadness, to feel our grief, to feel these things, to let other people see us feeling these things, to let them in to support us, to see us, to feel us, to care for us in those feelings. But that it's tempered in the way that you temper steel, that I'm not just throwing out my vulnerability in a way that is like tone deaf, like feeling tone deaf to another person's capacity or care levels or whatever. It's mindful, but it's honest, you know, and when it comes up, we don't flinch. We just let it be with us. And we're also ready and willing to let people in when the time is right, when they're there to care, and when they're capable, and when it's in service to something greater than our own satisfactions or theirs.
That's beautiful, man. I think you really nailed that one.
Thanks.
Great, great answer. Okay, so where can people find you, get a hold of you? Are you on social media, Instagram, any of the accounts?
So primarily I use Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Although, again, Facebook, please do follow me on Facebook, but you know, like at James W. Jessup, it's all there at James W. Jessup, all three of those accounts. But increasingly, I mean, like Facebook is geared towards like, you're not going to see it if you didn't pay for it.
Yeah.
Or if I don't pay for you to see it kind of thing. So best to probably follow me on Twitter or Instagram at James W. Jessup. I also have a subreddit, which is at Mind Podcast, our at Mind Podcast. It's a great place to be and to subscribe to me on YouTube. And I have two channels on YouTube. They're both there, but you can find it by searching Adventures Through the Mind or James W. Jessup, Adventures Through the Mind being my podcast. And I encourage people to check out my books if you want something a little bit more like textbook, psychology book-esque. check out Decomposing the Shadow. And if you're interested in the same content from more of a storytelling narrative, then to check out The True Light of Darkness.
Awesome. Thank you so much, brother. Really appreciate openly sharing. You're such a wordsmith. Things flow. The conversation was great. If you're listening to this, I highly, highly recommend the podcast At Mind, Adventures Through the Mind. Some amazing guests, amazing conversations. Just, you'll love it. I highly recommend it. Check that out. Follow James. And thank you so much for tuning in, liking, subscribing, following, whatever you guys choose to do. I appreciate that. I appreciate you guys. And I appreciate you, James. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, if you're into it, I'll give you a little inside scoop. I don't know when your podcast comes out that nobody else knows about now, just like for you and for your listeners, which is that yesterday I interviewed both Françoise Berzat and Roslyn Watts at the same time, mostly them having conversations about what it is to be a woman in psychedelic research, but also what it means to work with the mushrooms to help heal people from emotional struggles. Them being two of like the leading women in psychedelic field. It's a very exciting podcast for me. So just throwing that out there for your listeners and just—
When is that coming out? I'm curious.
it's going to come out within the next 6 weeks.
Okay.
The podcast is every 2 weeks, right? So within the next 6 weeks. So
nice. Yeah. Looking forward to it. Stay tuned. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, guys. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you soon. Peace.